everybody, and welcome to the ULT in Philadelphia. As is our custom, we will read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists and give you a list of announcements concerning the program for the coming days and weeks. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or the inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Newcomers, we invite you to pick up a copy of the Declaration on the table at the entrance. In addition to announcements and so forth, there are two, both sides, front and middle, interesting items for you to read. Now, the program for April, May, and June 2010 is always listed here. And we would like you to know that the entire work of the lodge is supported financially by voluntary contributions, not only of funds, but of work and even labor sometimes. But no obligation is imposed or implied. The topic for today, April the 25th, is Allegories of Plato. Theosophy in Symbols and Myths. We've been working on that for the month of April. And next month, beginning in May, we'll begin the topic Psychism and Spirituality. Now, we have a study class every Wednesday, and the doors here are opened at 5:30 so that you may come in and visit our library, our reference library. Doesn't close down until around 7:30. There you will find straight line theosophical literature, plus a librarian, a volunteer, who will inform you in detail about that evening's class, if necessary. 7:30, we close the library. Meeting begins at 7:45 and not over until 9. It's usually a study class, and in the present time, we're using The Ocean of Theosophy by, we say, WQJ. It stands for William Q. Judge. Now this study class is run by the whole group. We have one student who will read or give us a summary of the topic for that evening, and he will take answers to questions, anything, because it's a group endeavor. We help each other. Now in addition, the third Friday of each month, 7 till 8, the doors open at 6:30 p.m., comparative study of religions and philosophy. And for April, no, for May, the third Friday in May, the triangle and the star. We'd like to ask, is there any other data on the symposium coming up next? Not at this particular time. We're looking forward to that next symposium. The last one was very interesting down at the Constitution Center. We've covered all the details, and this morning, as we stated, the topic will be the allegories of Plato. And as is the custom, we give a reading from one of the theosophical volumes, and this morning it's from The Voice of the Silence. Don't forget, you can always purchase these books during, after library hours, and before the meeting begins, and certainly afterwards. There's always a student at the desk, and experience will show you that those books, for which there is hardly any charge other than the cost, are there for your benefit for study and consideration. They are priceless. The reading for this morning is from page 28 in The Voice of the Silence, and the topic is under the two paths. The seeds of wisdom cannot sprout and grow in airless space. To live and reap experience, the mind needs breadth and depth and points to draw it towards the diamond soul. Seek not those points in Maya's realm, but soar beyond illusion. Search the eternal and the changeless Sat. Mistrusting fancy's false suggestions. For mine is like a mirror, it gathers dust while it reflects. It needs the gentle breezes of soul wisdom to brush away the dust of our illusions. Seek, O beginner, to blend thy mind and soul. Shun ignorance, and likewise shun illusion. Avert thy face from world deceptions. Mistrust thy senses, they are false. But within the body, thy body, the shrine of thy sensations, seek in the impersonal for the eternal man. And having sought him out, look inward, thou art Buddha.
Good morning. Well, this morning we have quite a topic. It's amazing the amount of information that one finds in theosophy and how theosophy correlates to Plato's teachings. Until, of course, we came across the passage where HPB tells us that theosophy is identical to the philosophy of Plato. So that kind of makes sense. Today we'll talk a little bit about some of the history, a little bit about the person, and we'll review a couple of allegories, some things that correspond to theosophical teaching in the allegories. But first we'll start with a little about Plato from the SD. We're told that Plato's not merely the greatest philosopher of Greece. but he is an initiate into the mysteries. He is one who belongs psychically, more than an initiate, we should say. He is one who belongs psychically, mentally, and spiritually to the fifth round. He is a fifth rounder in this, our fourth round, which means he has of his own self-devised means and self-induced methods has progressed far beyond what men of today can really even comprehend. His teachings are imparted through myths and allegories. And his aim, interestingly, we find from HPV, was to raise the manus of the race and arouse the beauty of his hearers. His myths today are often viewed as fantasy. Some will even say that his myths were used by him to cover up the deficiencies in his own reasoning faculties, kind of like that he didn't get it. So he'd come up with these myths to paint over them. Yet his the effort to teach, but his efforts were to teach that there is a truth beyond what we can sense, that there is truth beyond what we can reason, and the efforts to understand his allegories, to fully apprehend his allegories, requires that we go beyond reason and sense. So, such a deep realm of reality cannot be fully apprehended, which are represented in his allegories, except by the philosopher who has been initiated into the mysteries. Okay, so then why should anybody read it if you're never going to understand it until you're initiated into the mysteries? Well, we're told that even though we may not fully apprehend his allegories, just recognizing that there's a distinction between the reality that is being taught and the illusion that most people cling on to, that there's a difference between ultimate truth and the false shadows of illusion that people accept for truth, just realizing there's a difference here and looking for the difference, that is a step forward in development. Therefore, opportunity lies simply in the effort to recognize that we live in a condition of imprisonment. We tend to cling to the sights and the sounds of the world around us, and we tend to mistake slavery to the world around us for freedom. And we tend to mistake the shadows of the world around us for reality. So let's take a look at an abbreviated presentation of the cave and see if we can't grasp some of the ideas that Plato was sharing. In the allegory of the cave, we are told that man is like a chained slave living in an underground den. The mouth of the cave opens toward the light, and this is our state from childhood. We're not able to see beyond that. We know what's in the cave. We know there's a light. Whatever's out there, we don't get it. We see the shadows of things that pass by, and we believe that the shadows of those things are reality. We are recognized by ourselves and by our peers in the cave as superior if we can identify that shadow faster than the other guy identified it. Or we're superior if we can identify a wider range of shadows than the next guy can. The allegory emphasizes that in the cave, those who are chained into the cave cannot just be released from his chains by another individual, because if he is, he will not be ready to deal with the realities outside his cave, as though he has to earn his way out of the cave. He will not recognize the realities for what they are, and if he were to be freed, he would want to return to the cave because he's not going to understand what's going on out there anyway, and he would... So therefore, he must free himself by his own effort when he's ready to do so. Once the prisoner is liberated and steps outside the cave, he now must grow accustomed to the new environment. And there are five tests or five challenges or five portals that he must successfully endure. The first of which is once he's freed from his chains, he must accustom himself to the new conditions and forsake his long-cherished illusions. He's got to let it go. The second, he must see or make the effort to see the unity of all in all. He's got to release his old passions and make the effort to see the unity of all. Third, he must show compassion to his fellow prisoners who were, rather than revel in his own happiness and be proud of his advancement, he's got to make the effort to show compassion to his fellow prisoners, and he has to detach himself completely from the false valuations, it said, the false valuations that determined whether you were a good prisoner or not, whether you were faster or better or any kind of hierarchical distinctions or conditions that were recognized as valuable in the cave, outside the cave, must be released. This is a test for him. Finally, were he to re-enter the cave, as in the path of renunciation rather than that of liberation, were he to re-enter the cave, he must maintain his posture despite threats and pleadings by his old friends who are still clinging to the illusions. If he's going to rejoin them, he must maintain his vision and his posture, which he has worked for. So we're told that this allegory can be interpreted mystically, psychologically, even politically. It has universal implications. The truth is that as the soul is initiated into higher degrees of awareness, it experiences a sense of strangeness, a new birth, until it has become accustomed to the sights and sounds of the higher planes of consciousness. It must become indifferent to the lower impulses of earthly life. And then finally here, the mystic who has chosen the path of renunciation and not of liberation, the mystic who has chosen the path of renunciation has to learn to preserve his vision of the unity of the unseen universe while moving among the shadows of earthly existence. Has to learn to bring back the soul's memory of its inward ascent and spiritual faculties while also becoming able to cope with the limitations of incarnated existence in the phenomenal world. And what's that saying? That's not just, you know, for initiates. That idea can be applied entirely to mankind if we accept that soul is immortal and we return and we continue to reincarnate. The invitation is to consider the idea that there's something within the individual, which is the storehouse of all the wisdom that we've accumulated through all of our lives. And if we maintain the posture and set up the conditions within ourselves that allows that wisdom, that allows us to have access to that wisdom, then the life that we live is going to be very different if we didn't set those conditions up and get involved in the deceptions and the illusions of the shadows around us. So, now, back to talking a little about Plato. His teachings descend to us from the 5th and 4th century BCE. He's the primary student of Socrates. He is with Socrates until Socrates' death. Thereafter, he spends time studying deeper mathematics and logic for a time, and then off to southern Italy, which is where Pythagoras, the century before, had set up his school. So he studies deeper into the Pythagorean philosophy, and then onward to Egypt, Persia, and Babylonia. By the time he gets to India, he's already been initiated into the mysteries. Plato claims no originality of teaching. Rather, he points to universal truths, the universal unity of truth. Because of Plato, the Socratic method of education descends to us. Because of Plato, the abstruse numerical system of Pythagoras is intelligible by the average man who makes the effort. Because of Plato, the psychological systems of Patanjali, the laws of Manu, and the doctrine of emanation from Buddha all reach the West. And in this case, the West, in his time, there was still the Western mind and the Eastern mind. It just wasn't the United States. You can picture where it is. So in his day, Plato is the link between East and West. Yet he had that responsibility to carefully guard the mysteries, to the secrets of the mystery school from the profane. He had an obligation to veil his teachings in symbolical language. Yet his profound teachings descended through generations of pledged disciples. Now in Athens, Plato opens a philosophical school. He teaches by means of the Socratic method. He also gives discourses, and he sets a standard of mental and moral ethics which were similar to that of the mystery schools. So he doesn't actually start, so to speak, a mystery school. However, his academy is regarded as akin to the mystery schools. A student who enters his academy first is taught music. Why? Because harmony and rhythm most easily follow. It is harmony and rhythm which follows its way deepest into the innermost recesses of the soul. So music is first. Second is gymnastics, physical education. Why? To make the physical temple worthy of its occupancy. This strikes a balance between body and soul, and by means of this type of education, fortitude, we are told, courage, and love of the beautiful develop within the individual, as well as mental and moral discipline, which is requisite for philosophical education for the next step. So they start with music and physical education. Interestingly, Plato at the time also warns the rulers of Athens to pay careful attention to the development of their music. Were bad qualities allowed to creep into music, the mental and moral stamina of the citizens are degraded. To this he added that all art should be subordinated to ethics and should be used as a mean for moral education. Now, Plato's system of thought, a wide-ranging system of thought, like theosophy, embraces worlds, the evolution of worlds, the correlation of forces, the development of physical forms, the indestructibility of matter and spirit. He emphasizes upon universals, causes. His causes evinced by his concern for the higher self in man, always looking to find the cause, the purpose, the universal behind the particular, the cause behind the effect. Ever seeking the cause behind the effect, yet he would always refrain from trying to describe the causeless cause. we are told that a divine idea, according to this philosophy, evolves out of eternal will and is the model upon which eventually the entire physical universe is built. Behind cause is law, behind law is intelligence, and this intelligence is an aspect of universal mind. This intelligence is reflected in the higher ego in man. Other doctrines that he taught included the laws of attraction and repulsion, the heliocentric system, the tracing of disease back to psychological causes, and the doctrines of races, deluges, and Atlantis, which had sunk 9,000 years earlier. Now, regarding that, we're going to read an excerpt from an article written by HPB. From the Timaeus and Critias of Plato. Now, this is set up where Seius, Solon was a legislator in Athens. And Solon is off after having accomplished what he needs to do in the legislature. He is off for 10 years to travel the world. At Seius, a city in the Nile Delta, Solon is honorably received by the priests of Athena, for both Athens and Seius were under the protection of the same goddess, Athena. In conversing with the learned guardians of the temple on the antiquities of their respective countries, Solon discovers that there were records in the sacred edifice of events which had happened 9,000 years previously and in which the inhabitants of his own country, Greece, had played a conspicuous part. Solon had spoken of the deluge of Deucalion and Pyrrha, and it goes on until one particular aged priest from Seius explains to Solon of Athens. He says, he explains to Solon the astronomical meaning of the myth of Phaethon, and how that there are successive cataclysms of fire and water destroying whole nations, and that a noble race that had once inhabited the land of Attica, Greece, whose deeds and institutions were said to have been most excellent of all, and how they conquered the inhabitants of the Atlantean island. Both themselves, the original Greeks, and their enemies, the Atlanteans, were destroyed by terrible earthquakes and deluges. Among the glorious deeds of the noble Greeks, the original inhabitants of this country, Attica, which is Greece, was their victory over a mighty hostile power from the Atlantic Ocean. This is another piece, so it seems like it's anachronistic, but it's just more or less a continuance. Their victory over a mighty hostile power from the Atlantic Ocean, which had pushed its conquest over all of Europe and Asia. Facing the Straits of Gibraltar was an island larger than Africa and Asia put together. Besides this main island, there were many smaller ones, so that it was easy to cross from one island to another as far as the further continent, which was America. And this continent was indeed a continent in the sea, the real sea, the Atlantic Ocean, as opposed to the Mediterranean Sea. In the Atlantic island, a powerful confederation of kings was formed who subdued the island itself and many of the smaller islands and also parts of the further continent, America. They also reduced Africa, within the straits as far as Egypt and reduced Europe as far as Italy. Further aggression, however, was stopped by the heroic action of the then inhabitants of Attica, Greece, who, taking the lead from the oppressed states, finally secured liberty to all who dwelt within the Pillars of Hercules, the Straits of Gibraltar. Subsequently, both races were destroyed by mighty cataclysms, which brought destruction in a single day and night, and the natural features of Greece were entirely changed, and the Atlantic island, Atlantis, sank bodily beneath the waves. Such are a few touches that are found in Plato's Timaeus and Critias. Above all else, Plato taught ethics. Ethics grounded in free will and the power of choice. The power of choice determines a man's parentage, hereditary tendencies, physical constitution, and his early education. The power of choice determines a man's stage in evolution, his position in society, and particular virtues that are necessary for his immediate development. And then Plato also spends other time talking about what's necessary for the state to operate properly and makes recommendations for behavior in society. It all gets all into the ethics of things. But the emphasis is on thinking from a universal point of view, operating from universals as the truth, not as particulars as the reality, and to achieving that by means of dialectic or dialogue, discussion, with the effort to recognize the principle of whatever the object is we're discussing. We trust that some of you have come with ideas that you care to share. Any contributions here? Yes.
Well, in the presentation of the allegory of the cave, we were thinking about how alcoholics and drug addicts in particular, among addictions, they are strongly cautioned not to go back to their former environs, the people, places, and things that they once associated with in those dens of iniquities or caves, which are, you know, bars or whatever, wherever they are, the crack houses, wherever they may be, because they'll be drawn back to it, to the addiction when they're weak. But there are those who, through experience and knowledge and effort over a period of years, can become counselors or psychologists and work with those people. Of course, they don't seek them out in the bars. They come to them. But it was a very, very interesting to hear the allegory presented that way, and we thought how in theosophy we should try to, when we can, correct small errors the fallacies where we see them, but of course using the Socratic method, not preaching. Nobody likes to be preached to. So we thought that was a very very good presentation of the allegory, and very clear. And that's what came to mind, how an addict wouldn't want to go back.
Thank you. Sure. So the contribution has it's saying that, hey, this is practical stuff, right? And leaving an unhealthy environment, whether it's the drug and alcohol abusive environment, or isn't it amazing even women who are trying to change their lives because of living in an abusive situation, there's still this tendency to go back anyway. We can draw all kinds of analogies. In the teachings, it says that it applies even to nations, to politics. We don't have immediate ideas, but maybe that'll come in the future. Yes?
What is the relationship between Plato and Pythagoras? I know they both held music in high esteem. Were there any other similarities in what they taught and what they
So what were some of the similarities between Plato and Pythagoras? Well, on the one hand, Plato, we are told that Plato echoed the teachings of Pythagoras in principle, but not by method. Pythagoras's method was by use of numerals. Numerals represented ideas. In Platonic philosophy, geometrical figures were used, like solids, you know, three-dimensional figures were used to share these ideas. And we have to say, as much as we read about it before we got up here, we just didn't get it. You know, there's the different solids, which are regular. They have the same shape all the way around. So there's, you know, the four-sided, six, eight. You know, they call it a dodecahedron, which is a 12-sided solid. And one day we'll understand more about it. But the ideas, the philosophy we understand is identical. It's just that their methods that they used, or their symbols that they used, differed. Any contributions along that line? Yes.
Well, just that if we look in nature, mm-hmm. you can see those very symbols. Everything is built up in exactly that manner. Either the triangle, the circle, the dodecahedron. We can find it. We may not understand it completely, but we can see that it is the best use of space. And maybe that's its reason.
Okay, so the contribution here is it could be he was demonstrating that nature uses that method to build because of its inherent efficiencies. Okay, and there's a hand here.
Well, to follow up on the previous comment, of recent year, physicists have developed the idea of fractals, which apparently are involved in the construction of all living organisms, and examined to their ultimate nature, they are geometrical organizations and figures that are just repetitively put together in different combinations and create the outlines of the various forms we see. But they can be reduced to these fractals, which are also geometrical figures and mathematical in nature. So we thought that's an interesting correlation to.
Thank you. Did we hear that the use of fractals by scientists today correlate to Plato's methodology by which he taught philosophy, using Plato, what are called Plato's solids, these three-dimensional forms? Yes.
Well, we just wanted to comment on the different geometric shapes. Well, we just recently saw on TV on one of the nature stations about the geometric shapes used in beehives, and they said that one of the things with the six-sided, I don't know what they're called, where they put the honey and
cells,
thank you, the cells, is that it's extremely strong,
mm-hmm.
and having the six sides, and plus it's optimum for space, so they can keep a lot of, you know, the honey and the eggs and all that. It's just a perfect shape for the need that they have.
Thank you. So another example we're talking about is the perfect shape in nature for the needs that are required. The one saying that comes to mind that we hear a lot is this idea that God geometrizes, and we are told that descends to us from the teachings of Plato. So one could think, well, God, well, how does God geometrize? What does that mean? You know, but if you think about it, what it's really saying, it's the verb form of geometry. To geometrize then would be to operate in accordance with geometrical measures. So really, it would seem that this idea of God geometrizes is the building of the universe. It follows a pattern. What's the key to understanding geometry? You have to understand the laws of geometry before you can ever hope to answer the questions. Yet once the laws are understood, some of the most complex geometrical questions on the page, really, there you can break it down if you know the basic building blocks of it. So in that sense, deity geometrizes. Yes.
We were wondering, because we think many people in the West, when they look at those geometrical figures, are in the same problem. They don't get the bigger picture. And perhaps that relates to the emphasis on our education, which is not music and moral, seeing the whole picture, even from the earliest ages, but rather from the very beginning, looks at details and particulars and trying to get more information.
Thank you.
Developing the synthetic aspect of our mind.
So the contribution has to do with how education gets us focused on the details and the particulars in math and other subjects as well, rather than looking at the whole picture by means of music. One of the challenges we've read with students in the 10th grade learning geometry is really that it's the first course that they've ever taken where they are required to think from universals to particulars. If you don't use that method in geometry, it's never going to happen. Everything else is going from particulars, from figuring out everything from chemistry equations to algebra, tends to be the opposite. And so the challenge is for the student to make that leap, which is why geometry is just so different from all the rest of the maths. Yes?
Well, we think a wonderful exercise is to go to the library and take out a book on fractals, because just seeing that one pattern as you zoom in on a particular inch of that pattern, you see that that pattern is absolutely still there in the minutest details. And when you begin to realize that in order to see what you're seeing, you would need a TV screen about 300 million miles wide, because that's how many magnifications you're dealing with, it makes you begin to see that everything in the universe is an expression of one and the same thing. Nature geometrizes.
So nature geometrizes. And so in that sense, yeah, you know, a lot of times was used the expression as above, so below, which is exactly what we're talking about here with fractals. Everything has the principles within it of everything else that is. So it's not a matter of what size is it, or what weight is it, or how do you personally value it, but rather, in essence, everything is one. And when we start from that basis, we have a whole different look at reality than by first figuring out what category things fit into. Yes?
Another recent, maybe not that recent example is of the use of geometry is Buckminster Fuller's construction of the geodesic dome, which is all based on geometric principles. And when he made a philosophy out of it, he was pushed aside.
Oh, is that right? So
Buckminster Fuller is now mostly recognized as a bit of an old crackpot.
And so as the engineer approached the philosophy and saw the purpose behind what he was doing,
he's written books on the underlying philosophy and all that. I mean, the geodesic dome was a wonderful architectural thing, but once he put the underlying philosophy of the whole and so on in, he was sort of pushed to the side.
And hence he
was a genius.
Put to the stake by the bishops of his science.
More or less.
Yes.
Well, one thing that we have picked up in these rooms is the broad picture concerning the return of great beings to the world to teach men. And recently we just finished cycles. And we look at the day of 1775 to 1830, when the country was constructed political basis for government in this country, not only from the standpoint of the officers, but in terms of the philosophy and the laws. Sound mighty platonic. And then in 1875, we had H.P.B. herself coming, and she brings it all in from east to west and west to east, and shows us the similarity of the various forms of government, political, moral, and ethical. So it's amazing how this study of Plato and Platonism seems to be as real. It's just fantastic if we stop.
Thank you. Yeah, so the contribution touched on the formation of the United States and how interesting it was to see that some of the ideas that Plato had in mind actually can be followed in the construction or the establishment of the American government. In particular, we see the value that is placed on the law being the rule of the land as opposed to the personal fiat of an individual, the king, the pope, or what have you. So there's the law, but also to be followed. Also, Plato, you know, it sounds, just to make it quick, not to say it sounds simplistic, but what he says is, you know, in society, he would talk about three types of folks. Those who were attached to their passional nature, who should be warriors. There were those who were attached to who lived in the life of their sensations, who should develop temperance, and such men should be laborers and builders. The second group lived in their passional nature, who should have opportunity to develop courage and fortitude to grow. They should be soldiers. The third class is that who has control over their lower nature, and they should aspire to wisdom. Such men should govern others, those who have control over their lower nature. Unless philosophers become rulers, or rulers become true students of philosophy, there will be no end to the troubles of the state and of humanity. And do we not see that? Yes.
It's interesting. I mean, there's a cycle or a pattern. All of the great teachers either spent time in India or Egypt, and in the West, they returned to the West with things that they learned there. This that you just spoke on sounds similar to the caste system in India. Was there any other things that were gathered that you know of from those sources?
Actually, let's see. He spoke of not a caste system to construct it per se, and you know we might not have brought those notes with us, but he spoke of the individual, first the individual who was attached either to his senses or to his passions, and you know, and how based on where you are, there are immediate lessons that you can learn, immediate virtues that you can learn if you do such and such, such as if it's the passional nature and you're grounded in your emotions. When he says that person should be a warrior to develop courage and fortitude, on the one hand, a warrior, a soldier, or in whatever category of life he is, maybe he would be, you know, say a police officer or some kind of enforcement, you see? So there are things that we can do that match where we are developed that strengthen us to rise to take the next step. That's what his message was, that society we understand it. Society should have stratas. There are stratas that fit, that people fit into based on their level of development. Yes, in the back.
Well, didn't Plato advocate grooming certain individuals, setting them aside for government service that were altruists, that would dedicate their lives to serving others without any kind of monetary gain? Do we have that?
Perhaps that's the case. I mean, we don't claim to have read everything he wrote. However, in the Theosophical articles that we read, it was interesting how he did place emphasis on, once you've done it, once you've been there and done that, once you've reached a certain level of personal development, yes, you do have the duty now to go back and be of service. You do have the duty to go back to the cave. You do have the duty to go back and be the ruler. You know, because once you get to a certain level of wisdom, he said that, you know, the best rulers that a democracy can have are the guys who don't want to do it because they know what a mess it can be. And then there was that phrase that, you know, the karma of wise men who choose not to participate in government is that they shall be governed by unwise men. Mm-hmm. Think about it. There's a follow-up. Sure.
Isn't it interesting how all our politicians like to call themselves outsiders, and they talk about the Beltway and I'm the outsider. Every one of them says they're an outsider coming in, going into that cave to clean things up. And it's people keep falling for it, it seems.
Shadows. Yes.
One of the points about Plato, which we don't think was mentioned, unlike other great teachers, he did write things down. But nothing of what he ever wrote was in his name. It was always his teacher, Socrates, who was involved in the dialogues. And we think in the entire dialogues, he as an individual, Plato, is mentioned maybe once or twice, but the teacher is not, he is not speaking as the teacher of all this. It's all referred back to his teacher, Socrates, what Socrates taught in these various dialogues with individuals.
Thank you. An interesting point pointed out here. And it did say, we saw that like HPB, he would point to the East. You know, these are not my ideas. I've received these ideas, and I'm passing them on. And in his writings, he walks his walk. You know, he doesn't talk about his personal views. Yes?
We're thinking the cave story was very well impressed on the race mind, because we're thinking of two or three ideas right away where it's in popular literature. But we did have a class here once on a film representation of that very story, and it was a part of the Matrix. And in the story, Neo, or the neophyte, has brought himself to a position where Morpheus, or the agent of change, to morph, comes to him and says, now it's time. You can continue as you're going, or you can decide to take the crucial step of looking at life as it really is. He goes that path and, as was just said, returns over and over again to those still suffering in the world of illusion to try and be of service. So it's everywhere. That story is repeated and continues to inspire us. And it is the journey, as was outlined, with the courage as the warrior begins to become the mind being and return to be of service. And it is what the masters say is the highest calling, to renunciate, as was said, the reward, and be of service.
So the point brought up is these archetypes in Platonic philosophy are found in pop culture, and they attract people, and they make money. but at least it's getting out there, you know? And it's not being presented in some religious... You know, no one's personally gaining spiritual false shadows. But it's out there, and when people recognize it, they're attracted to it. Similarly, bring up this idea to a friend in a sincere conversation and find out how deep you can get in that conversation. It's when it's a true archetype. Yes.
Well, it's interesting because people that are watching those kinds of films or reading those kinds of books, they may not really understand what it is that they're reading, but just like those of us that are reading the SD, a lot of times we don't understand what is being said either. But in both cases, though, the impression is there. It's like the seeds are being planted so that hopefully in a future time, you know, they'll blossom.
So the impression is there. The contribution here is the archetype is subliminally recognized, even though it's not recognized as an archetype. It's made its impression, and then other outward methods of reminding us of that archetype validates it. And we had the most fun playing on the idea of archetypes with, we have a nephew who's a teenager, how the archetype of Moses and how he was born into the whole, we all know the story of Moses, parallels Superman. And that's just an example. And that was not by accident that Superman's story of his birth was, it came out of nowhere. But it's a parallel, and it struck a chord in the student, and it was fun to do. Yes.
Well, just that the founders of Marvel Comics were students of theosophy. And tried to present some of these archetypes in a pop literature that would reach. They had been aware of those teachings.
Aha! Uh-huh, so founders of Marvel Comics were the theosophists. Thank you. Yes.
I think we would be surprised how many people have been touched by the theosophical teaching, and it's then reflected in their creative work. But we were thinking of a slogan: if the symbol fits, dare it.
Thank you. If the symbol fits, dare it. Think about it. Yes.
Just another comment to something we talked about earlier, about this country and the founders of this country. I think it's fairly well known that most or all of the founders were Freemasons.
Yeah, so the contribution, yes, most or all of the founders were Freemasons. And
when the Constitution was created, that is where it came from.
So we can certainly say that there was great influence, that great pressures put in the formation of the United States by Freemasonry. And what we meant to get to earlier when we emphasized the value of law, the rule of law that we place in this country, that simply stems from the Masonic, not today, but then the Masonic philosophy of deism, where what was taught was, they taught there's a God who created the universe, and then he left everything else to the law. And the clock is ticking according to law. And man controls his own destiny, not because there's not a God, this is what they said, but because he controls his own destiny as a matter of cause and effect. And the emphasis at the time by the Freemasons was the law is supreme, as opposed to, as we all know, the bishop or the king or the whatever. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the contribution. Yes.
Well, karma and reincarnation seems to have come to us after 1875, at least to us in the West here. And that is what that seems to be the basis for further study of faith and all of it. Karma and reincarnation. Missing.
Thank you for the contribution. And with that contribution, we'll leave you this one last we thought was interesting. A saying from Plato: those having lamps will pass them to others. Our meeting is adjourned.